Would you like to be able to start conversations like a pro? Take the Sunday World, your daily dose of what's going on. Do not consume the Sunday World if you're involved in a drug cartel, you're a politician with something to hide, or you've appeared on a reality TV show and care about others' opinions. Consume the Sunday World responsibly. Always read the stories, gossip, and commentary.
Wow, buddy! You look healthy and happy.
Veterinary surgeon and natural pet food pioneer John Burns knows the positive impact a natural diet has on our beloved pets. That's why he developed Burns Pet Nutrition.
Maybe I should try some of your pet food myself. Okay. I'll start with a salad.
For natural, no nasty, wholesome recipes, choose Burns Pet Nutrition. Available from veterinary clinics and all good pet shops across Ireland.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
We're back on the road this April with our live show, Cocaine Cowboys. If you want to hear the story of Ireland's love affair with Colombian powder and those who made millions in the gold rush, limited availability remains in Belfast at ulsterhall.co.uk. That's ulsterhall.co.uk.
Even saying it out now, You see it on the banners and you hear people saying it, it's such an emotive phrase. And it's almost now become something in Ireland that when you hear, you know what it relates to. As people start to panic and flee through this doorway, that mat was dislodged and the doors closed over. And you have those horrific accounts of people cramming into that entranceway and being overcome as the smoke rolled over them. Each and every single one of those exits pretty much had an issue with them.
I'm Nicola Tallant, and you're listening to Crime World, a podcast about criminals, drugs, and the sins of the underworld in Ireland and across the globe.
The verdict of unlawful killing at an inquest into the deaths of 48 people in the Stardust Disco brought to an end 4 decades of injustice. It was a result that once seemed almost impossible to Neil Featherston Hall when he sat down to write his book, They Never Came Home, 2 decades ago. Today, I'm talking to Sunday World reporter Neil about that book and about his long association with the brave Stardust families who never stopped fighting. I'm Niall Donald, and this is Crime World, a podcast from SundayWorld.com. So, Neil, I remember you telling me about attending the 20th anniversary for the victims of the Stardust Memorial and kind of how it was a grim scene where maybe the families felt that the fight for justice was at a low point and really at a struggle. For them to then get to this point last week where they have that verdict returned in an inquest of unlawful killing, like, it is an amazing turnaround. Where was that 20th anniversary held?
So that was an event in the Clonshock AUL complex, as far as I remember, Niall. And it's obviously, you know, more than 20 years ago now.
Yeah.
But the memories of that night still stand out. And I think just to put it, to explain how and why we were there, I was a news reporter with the Northside People newspaper. I wasn't there that long, maybe about a year, but this is one of the first big stories that I was covering, and I was sent down to this anniversary event. It was the 20th anniversary. And all I remember that night is, you know, I was familiar with the Stardust story, but not the detail.
Exactly.
And the kind of the impact it had on these people. We'd written about these people before, and I was familiar with some of the names, but to actually sit down and speak with them that night stays with me to this day.
Yeah. So, obviously the Stardust fire happened in 1981, so that was the year 2001, presumably, at that stage.
That's right.
And already, look, I remember the Stardust growing up the exact same as you, like from north side of Dublin, like yourself, and you would have heard of the Stardust and known people died, but you wouldn't have known the specifics of it, really.
Yeah.
But in 2001, the families had already been through a number of state inquiries, and, you know, that fight to get justice, it didn't seem like it was going anywhere, did it?
It felt at that point that it had kind of stalemated.
Yeah.
You know, they'd I just remember from that night again that, you know, while their determination was there, you know, to keep on seeking justice, it felt like there was an element of despair.
Yeah.
You know, like you said, it had been going on 20 years at that stage. It was 2001 in February, and they'd already been through a tribunal,
yeah,
you know, in the days and the year after the fire and various, you know, hearings after that. And they were still conducting candlelit vigils, protests outside the Dáil to try and get justice. At that point, it felt like it run to ground.
Yeah.
You know, and not to, you know, take too much of a plaudit here, but it felt like, you know, that's where the genesis of the book came from.
Yeah.
And when the book did come out in that same year, so it was a very quick turnaround that we published the book. I think it was published September in that year. There was a little bit more momentum,
yeah,
behind the campaign. And that I think the families felt that somebody was actually listening to them,
yeah,
for a change, you know, and rather than just being like you're a newspaper person yourself, you know, that Stardust is one of these things that we would be traditionally visit,
yeah,
on the anniversary each and every year, and then it's forgotten about until the next anniversary. And this was going on for 20 years. So the book was a little bit more of a substantial element, document for them to have.
Yeah, like you kind of look back at it and capture it all in one place, because the Stardust, of course, it was in the background always, but maybe not the focus of it. Of course, the book was called They Never Came Home, which again, does that title come from you, or because even this week or last week, yeah, they were holding up banners with that
expression.
Yeah.
It's such an emotive,
yeah,
phrase, isn't it? They never, yeah, came home. So like, you know, to give its full run out, they went out that, yeah, night to have a good night out, by all accounts. You know, Antoinette Keegan speaks about it being a brilliant night, poignantly.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was a Valentine's Day disco, as we know, in Stardust, which was the biggest, most popular venues in the north side of Dublin, if not all of Dublin at the time.
Yeah.
I read somewhere recently that they had a bus going from the city centre,
yeah, yeah,
out to the Stardust. I didn't realise that.
Yeah. They had, know, a capacity of 1,458, I think it is. So it's a huge venue.
Huge, absolutely massive. And just to finish the question about where did the phrase come from. So that was actually a title of a song by Christy Moore called They Never Came Home, the Stardust song.
Yeah.
And we took that title, the book, if you like, from the song.
Yeah.
But it was actually Christy Moore himself had heard one of the mothers using that expression in one of the radio interviews in the immediate aftermath of the fire, saying her children had gone out and they never came home. And I think that even saying it out now,
yeah,
you see it on the banners and you hear people saying it, it's such an emotive phrase. And it's almost now become something in Ireland that when you hear, you know what it relates to.
Exactly. So let's go back to what happened on the night. Yeah. So it was 1981, it was Friday the 13th.
Correct.
There was a Valentine's event. I think it was meant to be over 21s, but I think it said during the inquest the majority of people were 18 or under or whatever. So it was really a kind of a big congregation, like, you know, for teenagers and slightly older in the north side of Dublin. The event seemed to go well. As you said, people were having a great time,
yeah,
up until about 20 past one or so. What happened then? Like, what?
Yeah, I think it was a little bit later, probably about 1:41.
Yeah.
When you know, as you said, it wasn't packed to capacity that night. There was, yeah, there were more than 800 people there, so,
yeah,
it wasn't packed to capacity, but it was quite busy. And as you mentioned, it was supposed to be an over 21s event, but a lot of the people there were under actually 16.
Yeah.
Some of the victims were 16.
Yeah.
I think the eldest victim was in their late 20s. So you had a big mix of young people, predominantly young people at the Stardust. They'd gone out, as you say, on Friday the 13th into the early hours of Saturday the 14th, which obviously would be Valentine's Day. By all accounts, a great night. Everybody was out having fun. There was a disco dancing competition on, sponsored by KTEL.
Yeah.
So there was prizes given out for that. You know, we,
yeah,
actually spoke to some of the people in our book whose you know, their family members had competed in this event. And they were giving out the prizes. The DJs were playing all the songs of the day. When, by all accounts, was a small fire was,
yeah,
spotted in what's called the West Alcove area. It was a shielded off, cordoned off part.
Yeah, there was a main dance floor, and then there was a couple of other locations in.
Exactly. And because it wasn't packed to capacity, they had pulled the curtains down on this West Alcove because they didn't need the space.
Yeah.
And that's where, by all accounts, a very, very small fire was spotted on one of the seats.
Yeah.
And it didn't raise immediate
panic whatsoever. I mean, the disco dancing competition was still going on, but it was only when men who were working there, staff members, went over to try and tackle it ineffectively, as it turns out, with a fire extinguisher. When they lifted up that kind of curtain, if you like, that's when the flames started to spread quite rapidly. And of course, up the walls, along the ceiling, and within 8 minutes, from 1:41, 8 minutes later, it was an inferno.
Okay.
We're talking that quickly.
Yeah.
So the people in there may not have even noticed what was going on. And there was even some accounts that people thought it was a smoke effect, you know, like dry ice.
Yeah.
So there's no immediate panic. The DJ actually said at one stage, when he had noticed the flames, or it was pointed out to him, he asked the patrons, "No, small fire, no need to panic. Please make your way to the exits." Within seconds of him saying that, the lights start to fail, plunges the entire ballroom, if you like, into blackness, pitch dark.
Yeah.
And that's when all panic ensued. And then you have those horrible accounts of people trying to exit by any ways and means they could. This is where you have the accounts of fire exits being locked.
So obviously, like, a fire can occur in any building, you know.
Yeah.
They can start accidentally, electrical faults or whatever.
Yeah.
But of course, what happened in the Stardust, it's not just a result of that fire, is it the fact the fire started? What really, the tragedy occurs because of the fact that people couldn't get out.
Yes.
And that's what the fight for justice has been about, hasn't it? So it's been about, you know, there was, I think it was it 8 or 10, 8 exits anyway, fire exits in the building, possible fire exits.
I think there were 6. Actually, and there were
the two main doors, maybe.
Exactly. And so even the inquests that were held that only came to an end this year, there's still confusion about which exits were chained, were locked, were not unlocked, you know.
Exactly. So, like, if we get to that, like, so what happens is that, and it's maybe not dissimilar to the Hillsborough disaster in the UK, where, you know, something happens, but really what causes the tragedy is the logistics around it. And what happens in the Stardust is people go to these fire exits and they're blocked, basically.
Yeah.
Now, there's different accounts, there's different disputes. Mm. Those different accounts now are resolved because the inquest ruled, a jury of our peers decided that they were obstructed in one way or another.
Oh, absolutely. There's no doubt about that.
There is no doubt about that. So tell us what happened when people sort of tried to get to these various exits.
Okay, so basically, there were 6 main exits, and, you know, exit number 6, it's a little bit difficult to explain without having a map.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm reading it, the tribunal was satisfied that this door was locked.
Yeah.
When the Stardust opened at around 10 p.m. that night. Now, it was unlocked by the head doorman, Thomas Kennan, at around 12:20. But he left the chain and the padlock hanging on the panic bar.
Yeah.
And the first person to exit by this door was able to do so without difficulty.
Yeah.
But it's still, this is where the confusion comes about which doors, because they may have been unlocked, but they gave the impression that they were actually locked because the chains and the padlocks were still left on them. I think that's the same evidence that was found for exit number 5. But like you mentioned earlier, one of the main exits was exit number 2, which was actually the main entrance to the building. And this was different to the others in that it was not an emergency exit, it was just the main entrance. Yeah. And this is where the majority of people escaped through, but it caused horrific overcrowding. When the door, again, this door, particular door, was locked before the fire by a bouncer, and he opened it as people left the club. But when the alarm was first raised, he opened the door and he kept it open by wedging a doormat under it. Then, as people started to panic and flee through this doorway, that mat was dislodged and the doors closed over. And you have those horrific accounts of people cramming into that entranceway and being overcome as the smoke rolled over them.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of them would have collapsed.
Yeah.
And this is where a lot of the bodies were found. So that, you know, that's where some of the worst scenes took place. You have other exits, though, that were blocked, if not chained or unchained by, in one case, like a barrel of bottles that was impeding people's exits.
Yeah.
Another exit, number 3, was where a van
contained the DJ's equipment was parked directly outside the doors. So people trying to get out the doors, they could only get out a little bit before this van was in the way. So it's just a catastrophe. Each and every single one of those exits pretty much had an issue with them.
So, I mean, there's testimony given from survivors saying these were definitely locked. And some of the exits, not to get into which ones in particular, and they speak about trying to break the doors open and not being able to get through. Like, there's no dispute that, you know, what had happened in the Stardust was they'd started putting these chains and locks around the doors, and the management have admitted that at the very least, they were putting these on because some people had gotten in for free, and that was a big motivation. There was also, in the toilets, there was bars placed on the windows just shortly before the fire.
6 weeks.
6 weeks before, and there is really, really shocking testimony of people seeing, you know, trying to get through there and seeing hands, and there was also metal plates put in there. So there was all of these things were put in place because some people have bunked in free, basically.
To escape the £3 entry fee that was charged on that particular night. Just to correct what I said there, the bars on the windows of the toilets were already there. It was the steel plates that were welded on 6 weeks. 6 weeks before the fire, and that was to stop people from gaining entrance into it. And so, you're right, some of the worst testimony is from people on the outside trying to get those people out through bars, which were probably no larger than a few inches.
Yeah.
And horrifically, I remember one account of somebody telling the people inside to lie down so that the smoke
could come out,
go over them.
Yeah.
Other people saying how they were sticking their heads into the toilets themselves to try and, you know, save themselves. Some of the bodies were found in there. It was basically that was a trap.
Yeah.
People who were fleeing, who may not have known the layout of a disco. I mean, you go into places these days, who's actually, and they tell you to be aware of fire exits, right? Who actually goes into clubs and notes exactly where all the fire exits were? So they're fleeing. The doors into the toilets could have looked like an exit.
Yeah.
Like I said, that was a trap. There was no way out
for
those people there. And they are some of the worst scenes that were actually captured by RTE News of people on the outside, on the windowsills. And you can see the hands.
Yeah.
Coming through, they were some of the worst scenes that were captured on the night. Absolutely.
So there's no doubt that a lot of these measures were put in place to save a few quid. I mean, there's the testimony in the inquest went on for 113 days, was it, or something?
Yeah.
And you hear, you know, lots of details that are undisputable, that there was no fire training, that there had been issues raised by a guard sergeant who'd said it was overcrowded, and there was also issues raised by a corporation inspection about fire hazards. But it nothing had happened really. Mm. So we also heard obviously from Eamon Butterley during the testimony. Eamon Butterley was the owner of the Stardust, and his role, you know, became controversial for loads of reasons, obviously because he was the owner.
Yeah.
There was also discussion in the inquest, and it was also findings about some of the materials used on the walls and on the ceilings of the disco.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Eamon Butterley, you know, obviously is all eyes were on him.
Yeah.
When he turned up the inquest, and I think I'd read somewhere that for many of those people involved in the Stardust, victims' families, other people connected with Stardust, ourselves as authors of the book, that's the first time we've ever heard him speak.
Yeah.
He kept a very low profile over the years. In fact, for the book, we approached him several times. I do believe that, you know, we'd sent letters, registers letters to him, which were ignored. And then Darren Kinsley, who's working as a researcher on the book, approached him.
Yeah.
And he basically told him, I'm not doing any interviews. Yeah. We felt at the time that was a lost chance for him to have his say. We were trying to be not judgmental.
Yeah.
You know, trying to give him, you know, the fair crack of the whip, as it were, to have his say. But he had absolutely no interest. And I think that was also illustrated by the fact that he did go to the inquests, but was not going to speak outside of those inquests. And of course, he obviously, before the inquest finding that they were unlawfully killed, he tried to get that thrown out before that finding. So, you know,
because when he did take to the stand, he was very insistent that the doors had been open, that he had done nothing wrong.
Yeah.
Now, that's his take. The inquest have made findings which we can say, well, they have found that those doors were impeded at the very least. So that's a statement of fact now, yeah, as a court. But there was also the discussion about some of the materials used, yeah, as well. I mean, they really played a factor, because there was harrowing evidence about bits of the ceiling melting and falling on top of people, which I thought was, you know, just the image of it.
Yeah.
When you hear it described, you can imagine it happening, of course.
Of course, yeah. So these are the infamous materials that, you know, were carpet tiles, effectively. He bought, we understand, as a cheap job lot.
Yeah.
But, you know, we're not excusing what he did, but, you know, it wouldn't have been unknown at that time for people to use, you know, cheaper material on walls, on, yeah, ceilings of venues, without taking into consideration whatsoever,
yeah,
what potential risks,
yeah,
they would pose. I mean, you know, this is, what, 40-odd years ago.
Yeah.
And yes, there were inspections carried out at Stardust beforehand where concerns had been raised,
yeah,
and ignored. It just... relating back to Buttery there for a moment, like in his evidence, I suppose he was accused of basically throwing some of the doormen under the bus.
Yeah.
You know, where he had said that was not his policy.
Yeah.
That was conducted by, you know, people that had worked there off their own initiative, which they would also dispute.
Yeah.
But regardless, you know, you're talking about a different time when perhaps the same considerations about safety in general, fire safety in particular, were just... at best, disregard it.
Yeah, and that is true. We do live in a different world where things have changed. However, Eamon Butterley, part of some of the reason that the families had so many issues with him was that he, even in the aftermath of the Stardust, as you said, there was an initial inquest and then there was a tribunal report.
Yeah.
The tribunal report erroneously made the finding that it had been an arson, somebody had started a fire. That's been overturned now, effectively,
yeah,
in the inquest, who returned a verdict that it was an accidental electrical fault. But in the aftermath of that first tribunal, which was a real blow to the families, Eamon Butterley also sought and received compensation.
He did.
Of what, I think it was 500,000 or something along that lines.
He is, because so to clarify that point, some of the people say, what did Stardust families hope to have achieved from this inquest, yeah, now 41 years later? You just hit on that there.
Yeah.
The initial finding of the tribunal, was heard by Justice Rowan Keane, found that it was probably arson.
Yeah.
To say that erroneously pointed a finger of blame at every single person that was in there that, yeah, night. Victims, survivors, even the staff.
Yeah.
And that is the one key.
Yeah.
You know, all the other issues about the Stardust that need to be addressed and have been addressed, the doors being unlocked and who won what money. That was the key finding of that tribunal, which sat.
Yeah.
I wouldn't even say sat uneasily with the families, which
well, horrified them, I think.
Horrified them. Like, yeah, you know, while they were, and that was not that long after Stardust that tribunal was heard, like, yeah, within a year.
Yeah.
So there were still grieving families that now had to live with this finger of blame.
Which is again not dissimilar to Hillsborough, because that's how those families felt as well, that they were kind of, it was said that they were sort of hooliganism led to this crush, yeah, and also that the famous stories about people being dead bodies being pickpocketed. Like, nothing, they never thought this was going to, anything could bring back their family members, obviously, but it was the slur on their reputations that they were in, you know, played some role in their own demise, I think. And that's, I think, similar for the Stardust family.
Absolutely. And just getting back to that point you made about, so the finding of probably arson opened the door for the Butterleys to sue,
yeah,
the corporation for malicious damage claim they took,
yeah,
against the state. They received a total of £580,000 at, yeah, the time in compensation. To put that in context, the average house price that part of Dublin would have been about £30,000 to £35,000. So they won £580,000. In comparison, 1986,
yeah,
5 years after the fire, the Victims' Compensation Tribunal awarded £10.5 million,
yeah,
to the Stardust families amongst 823 people.
Yeah.
So you divide, it sounds like a big figure,
yeah,
and it is, but when you divide it amongst those people, it said the majority of individuals received between £5,000 and £10,000.
Yeah.
Parents who lost a child in disaster received a maximum of £7,500.
Yeah. I mean, a pittance.
So the McDermott family lost three in the fire would have gotten about just over £22,000 in comparison to the Butterleys effectively walking away £580,000. And that's yet another smack in of injustice, another layer of insult to the families.
So, Neil, so like you've obviously spoken to many of the families, in particular Anthony Keegan as you know, probably the face of the Stardust fight to a degree. Antoinette has become what have been your impressions on even the toll of because we all know, or we both know from working in newspapers, that there's always a novel thing, something like this happens and everybody's trying to talk to somebody, and then over time people, you know, they want the stories, they don't want to keep it going.
Yeah.
So it becomes even more difficult for families to keep highlighting stuff, I think.
Yeah.
What was that, that sort of toll? Because, I mean, she, you know, and nobody could ever say that she has not dedicated a huge amount of her life to seeking. Of course, she was a survivor herself. She was there on the night. Didn't just lose a family member.
Yeah, she lost two. Yeah, her two sisters. Antoinette, you know, I don't know if viewers can see it, but, you know, that's her parents on the cover of the book.
Right.
That's John Keegan and Christine Keegan at the funerals for one of the daughters. So it's fair to say that the Keegan family were front and center of the Stardust Victims Campaign. They were all members of the Stardust Victims Campaign, amongst others, which, you know, shouldn't be forgotten. But you're right. I mean, to be honest with you, when we were writing the book, there were some families associated with Stardust that didn't want to be involved, and we had to respect that because they wanted to move on.
Yeah.
And in fact, you know, there would have been a hint or suggestion that perhaps the others should leave it alone. That was just, you know, making it more difficult for some of the others to move on. So there was definitely that sense. But as far as the Keegan family were concerned and others, there was absolutely no way, you know, that they could just take their money and, you know, in some way, shape, or form, move on with their lives. It took over their lives, you know. And the impact and the toll that you refer to there, we actually touched on this in the book, which is actually quite harrowing.
Yeah.
In that there was a study of some of the victims carried out in the years afterwards. And we're told that there had been 25 attempted suicides by people affected by the Stardust tragedy at a court hearing for a girl who'd already been compensated for her injuries, who had taken her own life.
Yeah.
This is 1986. So, and then, you know, I won't go into the detail, but these kind of studies that were carried out with some of the victims, you know, there was depressive reactions, disorientation, increased alcohol intake, personality the absolute, we know it's good that we hear all about the people who died in the fire. Over 240 people were injured.
Yeah.
And then outside of that, you've all the other people who never even seen justice.
Yeah.
You know, one of the people that jumps out for me is John Keegan. Yeah. I didn't meet John. He passed away before we did the book, but he passed away.
Yeah.
Of a broken heart after losing his two daughters. There was no way he could just move on with his life, you know? And another gentleman I actually interviewed for the book, Albert Buckley, whose brother Jimmy died, you know, and Albert passed away not long after the book was written as well. So you have all these people, Christine Keegan, should we not forget, who's very much the face of the Stardust Victims Campaign, passed away, you know, so several years ago, having not seen justice. So you have this toll outside of the 48 victims who quite rightly we hear a lot about, and we had those beautiful pen portraits at the start of the inquest, giving them, you know, a bit more to their character rather than just a name. You know, they variously described as hard workers, loved disco dancing, fun loving, and, you know, in a lot of cases as well, let's not forget, some of them were the main breadwinners in their families. Yeah. Gertie Barrett lost her son Michael. He was, I think, 17. He was an apprentice plumber. He was the sole earner for that family.
Yeah,
four children.
Yeah.
So when she lost him, it wasn't just,
you know, the loss of Michael, which obviously devastated her to this day. But the fact that the family were on their knees anyway,
yeah,
you know, and she remarks in the book saying to God, you know, what have you done?
Yeah.
So it wasn't just the loss of her son. It was the four children left barefoot.
Yeah. Yeah.
She got an electricity bill. She got a warning from the electricity company that their electricity was about to be cut off, I think, not long after the funeral. She buried Michael. So this is the impact on the rest of the families, perhaps that we don't hear that much about.
Yeah.
The toll, as you mentioned at the start, to that point.
Yeah, I mean, it's an incredible level of trauma that then gets passed down through generations. And I did hear, I'm sorry, your name escapes me, but a woman now speaking about, I think she was four when her mother died in the Stardust, who had just gone out. She was the daughter of a single mother. Just her whole life changed from that moment on.
Absolutely.
You know?
You have Lisa Lawler. She was famously the Stardust baby.
Yeah.
She was orphaned.
Yeah.
By the Blaze when both her parents died, you know. She was interviewed for the book. She's written her own book as well. And speaks in the book, again, which is 20 years ago. So perhaps, you know, she's changed. But she said, you know, she can't.
Yeah.
She can't move on.
Yeah.
Like, it's not a case that, you know, just because of the passing of the years. And I think that that's why these inquests were so important.
Yeah.
Like, this year. And I think, like, as we mentioned, just coming in here, that, you know, they've got an apology.
Yeah.
Which obviously meant an awful lot to them as well. There's a redress scheme that's been discussed. And I don't think it's going to go away.
No.
I don't think this is the end of it now. I don't think, you know, okay, they've got their justice. That's all done. You know, I think the campaign is going to continue.
Yeah.
And I think that's a good thing.
Yeah, I think even broader picture again, you have to see, I suppose, what a bit like that human spirit and that bit of organization and a community working together can achieve. I think that, you know, you have to commend that they can, because they had to push the state dragging and screaming all the way now, not obviously talking about the politicians who were gracious in their apology this week, but the state as a whole was dragged kicking and screaming to this point over 40 years. I mean, it is an incredible achievement.
It really is. And, you know, at the time, you know, all you can, the best you could say about the government and the state at the time was just inept.
Yeah.
You know, it was a different time, but like people's, you know, the treatment of people was negligent at best. You know, no counselling,
nobody,
no support systems. I know it was a different time, but it almost like it didn't matter.
Yeah.
And again, this is something that crops up quite a lot, you know, particularly our coverage back on the Northside People days and in the book, an expression that was used that if this had happened in Donnybrook and not Bonnybrook, we wouldn't be having this conversation because this inquest would have been held 40 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, and there's, whether that's right or wrong, that's the belief.
Yeah.
That they were treated differently because they were from a particular part of Dublin.
Yeah.
And of a particular class of people.
Yeah.
And, you know, whether you subscribe to that or not, that's what some of those families believe to this day.
Well, look, I mean, the history of Ireland has shown that is not an unreasonable belief. Because, I mean, it's effectively a wiping out of a generation of people from a particular part of the north side of Dublin, isn't it?
Like, yeah,
I mean,
absolutely. Like, not one family or household was unaffected.
Yeah.
You know, in that, not just the families of the victims and those who were injured, but whole communities. You know, like we covered the book as well about how when the funerals began, there were 5-6 funerals every day.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, a lot of the kids, for want of a better word, that had gone to that disco that night worked together.
Yeah.
In Super Queen, I think it was known as at the time. You know, you had butchers and, you know, colleagues, you know, they would have been all pals with each other. Schools.
Yeah.
You know, classmates just disappeared.
Yeah.
Overnight. And It did. It to this day, if you go there, you know, maybe, you know, I'm putting too much into it, but we went to the Stardust, you know, when we were writing the book, and it's still eerie because the facade is still there.
Yeah.
You know, it's changed a little bit, but the iconic, if you want, front doors still look exactly the same. And there's an eerie, palpable sense of loss and tragedy there, and that emanates out from ground zero, if you like, of the Stardust, and into the, it leaks into the communities around it. And, you know, I was, you know, too young at the time to actually remember it. But you speak to anybody of that generation who's not even from the north side of Dublin, but they remember it. They remember it so well. They know where they were. It was like our 9/11 moment, you know. And then we had the accounts of, like, there's another person who never actually got to see Justice in the End, was Charlie Bird, who became synonymous with the Stardust campaign from, as a young reporter himself, being sent out there. And I was watching one of his interviews recently where he described being told to get over to the north side from where he was living on the south side.
Yeah.
There's a fire. And he said he was driving past the morgue that night and already the ambulances were lining up.
Yeah.
So his recollections as you know, professional, if you like, on the scene, stayed with him. And as we know, stood side by side with the Stardust families until his own untimely death, I suppose, there recently.
Yeah. So look, I mean, what happens next, we'll have to see, but it's something that we'd love to come back to again, because it's great to see. I think the inquest didn't sort of generate, because it was so technical, but it's great to see the story covered so comprehensively and across the world as well. And, you know, for the families, just to end and say, like, that is the verdict, is unlawful killing.
Unlawful killing.
That means that they died in an unlawful way, not to state the obvious. And that is something that was resisted for many, many, many years. So thanks, Neil. And, you know, it's great to... It's great to have played a role as a journalist, in a small role in it.
Absolutely, and you know, it at the time it was very important work. It felt very important, the work we were doing, but I didn't realise just how much how important it was to kind of keep it out there in the public eye, and you know, to see it. Obviously, over the years, I wouldn't be as closely working on those stories, but you know, it was the first book that I'd sat down to write with my co-author Tony McCullough, and it's probably one of those things you'll take with you out of a career that was worthwhile.
Yeah
You know, it played its part, a small part, but it played its part.
Great stuff, Neil. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Noah.
You've been listening to Crime World, a podcast from sundayworld.com, produced by Ian Mullaney and edited by me, Nicola Tallant. Research assistant is Claude Amini. If you like this show and love true crime, leave us a review. Or why not download the free sundayworld.com app for lots more stories from Ireland and across the globe.
Would you like to be able to start conversations like a pro? Take the Sunday World, your daily dose of what's going on. Do not consume the Sunday World if you're involved in a drug cartel, you're a politician with something to hide, or you've appeared on a reality TV show and care about others' opinions. Consume the Sunday World responsibly. Always read the stories, gossip, and commentary.